You know, when you're looking at a market worth $2.46 trillion, you really just expect the institutions holding the biggest slices of the pie to be, well, practically immovable.
Yeah, you really do.
I mean, you expect their legacy and those massive branch networks to basically guarantee their market share.
Right, forever.
Exactly. But today, our mission on this deep dive is to decode a really fascinating structural collapse in that exact assumption. We are tearing into this May 2026 article from the Broker Times by Jennifer Austin, and the headline alone paints just a brutal picture. It's called Westpac's Market Share Bleed.
And honestly, bleed perfectly captures the trajectory there. I mean, we are looking at Westpac, which is historically one of the most dominant forces in Australian lending, dropping from a 23.9% market share back in March 2019 all the way down to 20.7% in 2026.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a 3.2 percentage point slide.
Okay, let's unpack this because a 3.2 point drop in a $2.46 trillion space, that isn't just a bad quarter.
No, not at all.
Right, it isn't statistical noise. This is literally tens of billions of dollars just walking out the door. And it signals a complete rewiring of how mortgage brokers are deciding where to route your files.
Yeah, and that underlying behavior is really the real story here. Because this isn't about, retail consumers casually walking past a Westpac branch and deciding to bank somewhere else.
Right. They aren't just walking into the place next door.
Exactly. It's about the broker channel. Brokers control the vast majority of prime residential flow today, and they operate with this really ruthless sensitivity to operational friction.
They just want the path of least resistance.
Precisely. They have realized the market has completely resorted itself around speed, around internal policy nuances, and yeah, that path of least resistance, rather than just who has the biggest marketing budget.
Well, and if a giant like Westpac is bleeding out that much volume in a closed ecosystem, I mean, that money is actively being rerouted. Someone else is catching that flow. But the source material highlights this massive contradiction right out of the gate. Commonwealth Bank, or CBA, they actually consolidated their top position. They moved from 25.1% to 25.4%,
Yeah, they actually grew.
which is wild because they did this while navigating a very public $1 billion fraud probe. I mean, you would assume a scandal of that magnitude would just crater their broker flow.
You'd think so, but it actually highlights just how pragmatic the broker market is. I mean, the fraud probe is obviously a massive corporate headache, but on the ground, a broker's primary mandate is just getting a client's file to settlement.
That's all they care about at the end of the day.
Right. And CBA held their ground through sheer operational consistency. They invested heavily in their back-end technology, they kept their prime pricing relatively sharp, and they built a really highly proactive retention model. They basically minimized the friction of doing business.
Meanwhile, Westpac created
A
friction.
lot of it.
Yeah. The data points to three main culprits here. Their turnaround times blew out, their prime pricing lost its competitive edge, and brokers really perceived a severe narrowing of their lending
Like
appetite.
they didn't want the business.
Exactly. Even on clean files, brokers felt Westpac was actively looking for reasons to say no. It's like, imagine doing your weekly shop at this massive legacy supermarket for 10 years.
Like, yeah.
The produce is fine, but recently their checkout lines have become just agonizingly slow. The self-checkout machines crash, the managers are suddenly auditing every coupon you have, and it takes an hour just to leave the store.
Right, it's exhausting.
Right. And meanwhile, the boutique grocer next door has retooled their entire floor plan to get you in and out in 3 minutes flat. You don't necessarily hate the legacy supermarket, but your time is your margin, so you route to the boutique grocer.
What's fascinating here is how perfectly Macquarie fits that boutique grocer profile in your analogy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they've been on this multi-year ascent by essentially turning turnaround times into a weapon. They became the absolute fastest at returning formal approvals
Wow.
because they recognize that in a high-volume brokerage, operational speed is a literal currency. And they backed it up with BDMs, or business development managers, who actually have the authority to push deals through rather than just acting as messengers.
Speed as a currency. I like that. And it isn't just Macquarie capitalizing on this friction, right? Because the non-banks, your Brightons, your Peppers, Resimac, they're suddenly absorbing prime borrowers too.
Oh, absolutely.
These are PAYG clients, standard salaried employees with massive equity who historically would have just defaulted straight to a major bank.
Yeah. Well, the non-banks realized years ago that they couldn't fight a ground war against the majors on brand awareness or even on headline interest. interest rates. So they pivoted. They competed on policy clarity and SLA consistency.
Service level agreements, right?
Exactly. How fast they promised to process a file. And the major banks either just didn't see this pivot coming, or their legacy tech stacks prevented them from reacting quickly enough. Brokers recognized this operational reality long before the legacy lenders bothered to update their playbooks.
Which brings up a really critical tension in the market right now, because if I'm a borrower and I'm looking at a billboard, the first metric I lock onto is the headline rate.
Of course, everybody does.
Right. If I see a major advertising 5.9% and a non-bank is at like 6.1%, my instinct is to demand the 5.9.
It's just human nature.
Exactly. Wait, so you're telling me the lowest interest rate advertised on a billboard might actually cost a borrower significantly more over 3 years than a seemingly higher rate from a non-bank?
I am. The article essentially declares the death of the headline rate as a reliable proxy for the best deal. It is a massive paradigm shift.
So it's basically a trap.
It is entirely a trap. Brokers are now modeling the total cost of the loan over a typical 3-year hold period. Because the majors have historically used these heavy cashback offers to artificially sweeten the upfront deal, right?
Like giving you $3,000 just to sign.
Exactly. But to subsidize that cashback, they often attach higher annual package fees, they strip out favorable offset arrangements, and they maintain this history of aggressive, out-of-cycle rate hikes on their existing books, all while offering steep discounts to new acquisitions.
So it's a structural bait and switch.
Yep.
You get the $3,000 up front,
yep.
But by year three, the creeping fees and the back-end rate trajectory have just completely cannibalized your savings.
Precisely.
The borrower actually loses money chasing the lowest billboard number.
And non-banks have capitalized on this exact math. They stripped away all that cashback noise to offer genuinely competitive, low-maintenance products. And there's a really vital secondary benefit for the broker here, too.
Oh, what's that?
A low-maintenance loan from a non-bank doesn't require the broker to spend hours post-settlement fighting administrative errors or calling up the bank to renegotiate creeping rates. Because every time a broker has to intervene on a settled file, it just erodes the margin on their trail commission.
They're losing money by spending time on old clients.
Exactly.
But, I mean, the broker still has to sell that logic to the client sitting right across the desk who's pointing at the billboard. And the justification isn't just a tough conversation anymore, right? Because it's heavily regulated now.
Extremely regulated.
ASIC's Best Interest Duty Review, the BID, it basically turned the act of choosing a lender into what the article calls a regulatory artifact.
Yes. The documentation of the decision is now just as critical as the financial outcome itself. A broker can't just route a file to a major bank out of habit anymore.
Because they'll get audited.
Exactly. They are legally required to explicitly document a comparison of 3 or 4 credible lenders. They have to provide a written mathematical rationale for why the chosen product serves the client's best financial interests over time.
So if a broker recommends a non-bank with a slightly higher headline rate, they are heavily relying on that 3-year total cost math to prove it's cheaper.
Right.
And that BD documentation, I guess, acts as their compliance shield during an audit, but it also kind of doubles as their competitive moat against a client just walking into a retail bank branch, doesn't it?
That's a great point.
Okay.
Because the branch staffer only sells one suite of products, their own.
Right.
But the broker is manufacturing a customized, fully audited financial strategy. In an environment that's just saturated with information and marketing noise, that documented analysis is the core value proposition of the entire broker channel.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if habit-based routing is both a regulatory risk and a margin killer, brokers need an actual framework to actively sort these files.
They need a system.
Yeah. And the article breaks this down into this brilliant 5-tier routing map. But instead of us just listing them out, let's look at how they actually function. It reminds me a lot of medical triage.
Oh, how so?
Well, you don't send a simple sprained ankle to cardiovascular surgery.
No, obviously not.
And you don't send complex internal bleeding to a rapid response walk-in clinic. You match the complexity of the patient to the specific capabilities of the facility.
Applying that triage model to the current lending landscape is highly effective, actually. Because if we look at the first 2 tiers, it's essentially a battle of pure speed versus structural complexity.
Okay, so break that down. Tier 1.
Tier 1 is your sprained ankle. It's a clean, time-sensitive file. You've got a standard PAYG borrower, clean credit history, and a loan-to-value ratio, the LVR, under 80%.
Super straightforward.
Right. So you route this for pure velocity. Macquarie is the apex predator here, with the NA acting as the strongest major bank right behind them. If the liability is clean, these lenders issue formal approvals in days, sometimes hours.
But the moment you introduce structural complexity, say split loans across different properties, cross-collateralization, or multiple guarantors, you hit tier two. And the routing logic just completely flips.
It has to.
If you blindly send a complex guarantor structure to the speed kings at Macquarie just because they were fast on your last easy file, you are going to crash the deal.
They simply don't have the appetite or even the internal framework to untangle that kind of knot quickly. So for tier two, you route towards CBA and ANZ.
Okay.
Yeah, they have deliberately invested in these well-resourced, complex structure teams. They maintain the human capital that's required to manually assess and underwrite difficult files that an automated algorithm would just automatically reject.
So that handles the structure side of things. But then we get into serviceability and appetite, which brings us to tiers three and four. And the moment a borrower pushes past that 6x debt-to-income ceiling, the DTI, APRA's caps kick in.
Right, the regulator steps in.
Yeah, and the major banks practically shut their doors on borderline serviceability, forcing brokers to route those cases straight to the non-banks.
And to understand why this happens, we really have to look at the underlying funding mechanisms. The major banks are authorized deposit-taking institutions, or ADIs.
Meaning they hold our everyday savings accounts.
Exactly. They rely heavily on retail deposits to fund their lending. And because they hold retail money, the regulator, APRA, imposes incredibly strict capital adequacy ratios, particularly concerning those high DTI loans.
So they can't just lend recklessly.
Right. In fact, the majors often enforce internal quotas that are even more restrictive than APRA's mandated 20% cap, just to ensure they never even come close to breaching those capital requirements.
Wait, so they hit an invisible ceiling halfway through the quarter and just start declining perfectly viable borderline files?
Precisely. They just turn off the cap. Now, non-banks, on the other hand, operate outside that specific retail deposit framework.
Because they don't hold everyday savings accounts.
Exactly. They fund their books through wholesale funding markets, warehouse facilities, and residential mortgage-backed securities. Their institutional investors price risk differently, which completely frees the non-banks from those rigid retail capital constraints.
Wow, so they can actually absorb a 6.5 DTI loan without blowing up an internal quota.
Yes, they have the flexibility.
Which completely explains the routing for Tier 4, right?
Yeah.
The investment structures, things like self-managed super funds or really complex family trusts.
Yeah, exactly.
The majors, Westpac, CBA, Macquarie, they've aggressively pulled back from this space. It's just too capital intensive for their heavily regulated ADI models. Brokers are having to build entirely new networks of specialist non-banks and second-tier mutuals just to service their investor clients.
Yeah, think about the impact on the brokers themselves.
Mm.
If your entire brokerage was built on these legacy relationships with major bank BDMs, and your client base is heavily indexed toward investors or high DTI borrowers,
you're in trouble.
You are currently scrambling to rebuild your panel. The landscape has literally shifted beneath your feet.
Okay, so we sorted for speed in tier one, we've sorted for complexity in tier two, and we've navigated the APRA capital constraints for tiers three and four. But tier five is where the mechanics of the market turn genuinely vicious.
It gets aggressive.
Yeah, this is the refinance with retention risk.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, acquiring a net new customer in 2026 is incredibly expensive for a lender. Marketing, onboarding, it costs a fortune. Retaining an existing client is vastly cheaper.
Makes sense.
So when a broker decides to refinance a client away from a major bank, they have to submit what's called a discharge authority. And that document is the trigger.
It's the flare going up. I mean, the broker does all the heavy lifting, right? Running the DD analysis, finding the non-bank with the better three-year total cost, getting the client on board. And the absolute second they file the paperwork, the old bank's retention team swoops in.
Oh, and the retention intercept is a highly weaponized strategy now. The incumbent bank will immediately contact the borrower and offer just aggressive concessions. We're talking slashed rates, waived annual fees, direct cash injections, literally anything to kill the refinance.
Wow, they just undercut the broker at the 11th hour.
Every single time.
So Tier 5 writing becomes this really strategic game of beating the clock. You can't just pick the lender with the best product anymore. You have to pick the lender with the fastest processing SLA.
Exactly.
As a broker, you have to get the new file fully formally approved before you even submit the discharge authority to the incumbent bank.
You have to outrun them.
Yeah. You are literally getting the getaway car running, the doors open, and the new house keys in the client's hand before you even tell the old landlord you're moving out.
That's the perfect way to describe it. Because if you route a Tier 5 refinance to a lender known for slow turnarounds, the incumbent's retention team will intercept and kill the deal every single time. It's an environment where operational speed completely overrides product features.
So what does this all mean for the professionals actually navigating this $2.46 trillion space? Well, the Source article leaves us with a brilliant, really practical exercise. It's called the 60% test.
It's a brutal audit of self-awareness.
Oh, completely. That basically says, look at the last 20 files you've written. If more than 60% of those files went to just one or two lenders, your routing decisions are being driven by muscle memory, not performance data.
And statistically, across 20 disparate clients with varying LVRs, varying DTIs, and different structural complexities, it is virtually impossible that the exact same two lenders were the optimal BID compliant choice for 60% of them.
Right. The math just doesn't work.
It doesn't. A failure on this test indicates a broker operating on autopilot, which translates directly to slower outcomes and suboptimal pricing for the borrower.
And as we track the back end of 2026, there are really two major signals flashing on the dashboard. The first is Westpac's response to that 3.2-point bleed we started with.
They're feeling the heat.
Oh, for sure. They know exactly why they're losing flow, and they've promised significant capital investment into their broker channel infrastructure. If they can streamline those SLA turnarounds and widen their prime appetite a bit, we might see that market share floor actually stabilize.
And the second signal is the broader response of the major banks to the aggressive incursion of the non-banks. I mean, if players like Brighton, Pepper, and Resimac continue capturing this massive volume of clean prime flow, the majors will be forced into a counteroffensive.
They can't just sit there.
Exactly. We could see aggressive repricing strategies or even heavy lobbying to APRA to loosen those serviceability constraints. The resorting of this market is far from over.
Which brings me to a final thought I just can't shake. We started this deep dive looking at how habit and legacy branch networks used to guarantee a bank's slice of the pie. But when you look closely at that Tier 5 retention war we just talked about, it raises a massive question about the future of the industry.
Where does it go from here?
Right. Because if non-banks keep accelerating their back-end technology, like if we reach a point where formal approvals are generated algorithmically in a matter of hours instead of days, does the traditional retention team intercept become entirely obsolete?
Wow.
I mean, if the capital moves before the incumbent bank even realizes the client is looking at the door and the switching friction drops to absolute zero, does loyalty in banking simply cease to exist?
It really suggests a future where the entire multi-trillion dollar pie becomes just a highly liquid pool of capital, constantly shifting to whichever algorithm processes the fastest.
Something to mull over the next time you tap your card or stare at a billboard advertising a rock bottom rate. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden machinery of the mortgage market. Have a great week ahead.